The lifting of Govardhan Hill. Lifting of Govardhan Hill, and if we have time, we'll discuss about rescuing Nanda Maharaj from Varuna Loka, if we have time. So, lifting of Govardhan Hill, it's page 47 in our book. The Anatha witches being illustrated here. The Anatha which is being illustrated here is twofold, really. The fact that one doesn't need to worship demigods, and secondly, the tendency to think that one is an independent controller, or that one is basically independent from Krishna and doesn't need to take shelter of Krishna like that. But one is very qualified, and even one may feel that one is the supreme and is worshipable. So this pastime takes place immediately after the pastime of the correcting of the Brahmins. In fact, we know that while Krishna was going through this pastime with the Brahmins and their wives, at the same time he saw that the Brijbasis were preparing for this Indra Yajna, Indra Puja, because they were agricultural people, so they're dependent on water. Therefore, they had this practice of worshipping Indra, who's in charge of rainfall. So Krishna wanted to provoke Indra, actually. The thing was that Krishna, just some time before that, Lord Brahma had got carried away and there'd been the Brahma-Vimohana Leela. So this had made Lord Krishna a little concerned that how are these demigods doing? They seem to have a tendency to get a little carried away with themselves. He was thinking like that. And sure enough, in the meantime, Lord Indra had become puffed up since that Brahma-Vimohana Leela. And not only that, but Lord Krishna was also thinking, this is according to Sridhar Swami, the old commentator, great commentator on Srimad Bhagavatam, original Vaishnav commentator, more or less. So he says that Krishna was aware that Indra had become puffed up, and he was also concerned about some other of the demigods, that they might also become puffed up about him, about Krishna, and feel some resentment towards Lord Krishna. Can any of you think of one other demigod? You might have to use your imagination a little. But one other demigod who Krishna was concerned about. Yes, Varuna. And the next pastime of this nature is dealing with Varuna. So Lord Krishna, Sridhar Swami explains, Lord Krishna was already aware that Indra had become puffed up, and he was concerned that Varuna may also become puffed up, and he was becoming puffed up actually, and even some others. So Lord Krishna then, he wanted to provoke Indra. Sometimes great personalities do like that. If they see that someone is in Maya, then they may deal with that person in such a way to draw out the Maya. You know, a person's Maya is often a little bit beneath the surface, even though it may show subtly, but it may be more beneath the surface. So Krishna and even spiritual master sometimes may deal with a devotee in such a way to expose that fault, even though the devotee may be trying to hide the fault, or perhaps not even trying to hide it, but the fault may not be so openly manifest. So Krishna wanted to provoke Indra to draw out the Sanatha. So therefore, as a matter of etiquette, he addressed Nanda Maharaj and asked him, why are you doing this Indra Yajna? Is it really authentic, bona fide, Shastric performance, or is it just some folk ritual? And his father admitted that it's actually just a folk ritual, really, some family tradition like that. Krishna asked many different types of questions. Nanda Maharaj didn't want to answer. He was trying to say, you're too young. Krishna was saying, no, I'm not too young. I want to know. So he asked complicated questions to make it clear to Nanda Maharaj that he was really thinking deeply on the subject and he was really capable of understanding. He wanted to show him like that. And Krishna was saying, come on, you shouldn't keep any secrets from me, because I'm a family member. So I'm a friend, I'm not an enemy. One of our acharyas makes a very interesting point that Nanda Maharaj may have said that I don't want to explain this to you because I want to be even-minded. I want to be even-minded here. I don't want to disrespect Indra and I don't want to disrespect you. I want to be very even-minded. So I won't do what you're asking. I won't become influenced by you, but I'll just carry on with what the program that I've already decided on. I want to be even-minded. So I think it's Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, there's no such thing as being even-minded. Even-minded means that you may half accept one side and half accept the other side. So what does that mean? It means you're the enemy of both. You become the enemy of both because you're half against both. So there's a danger in supposedly trying to be sort of neutral. You actually end up being the enemy of both. Anyway, Krishna had two main reasons why he wanted to stop this yajna. Now we're going to ask about some of these points. They're smaller points, but we're going to ask about some of these points, so it might be a good idea to make note of these. So one of the main reasons he wanted to stop this Indra Yajna was he wanted to show there's no need to worship demigods because demigods only give temporary results. Then, secondly, he wanted to show that even the temporary result which the demigods give is given by him. So it's not even the demigods. It's actually him, Krishna. So these are the two main reasons. No need to worship demigods because they only give temporary results. And secondly, even those temporary results are given by Krishna and not really the demigods. The demigods are just representatives of Krishna. Krishna arranged this pastime because Krishna wanted to have another pastime in which he could relate with all the devotees at the same time. He had just done that with the Kaliya Damana Leela. All the devotees were involved, from the animals up to the gopis and everyone else. So in this pastime also, Krishna was looking forward to being able to have exchanges with all the devotees simultaneously, from the animals right up. Then Lord Krishna started preaching to Nanda Maharaj why he should stop the yajna. And he started preaching a philosophy which is called Karma Mimamsa, which is like an offshoot It's like a secondary Vedic philosophy. It's not really Vedic, but it's derived from the Vedas. It's not a bona fide Vedic philosophy, but it's sort of an offshoot from the Vedic tradition. Karma Mimamsa. And there are six main arguments. We want you to write these down too, because we're actually going to ask you to give three of these in our test. Any three of these six. So first point is that karma alone is sufficient in order to create a good future. Just karma alone is sufficient. What does this man want? Nothing to do with us? Oh, Krishna Priya, that's him right there. Okay, so karma alone is sufficient. In other words, there's no need for God. As long as you got your karma. Has everyone marked themselves present? Good. Secondly, that one's conditioned nature is the supreme controller. In other words, your future will develop simply on the basis of your conditioned nature. So conditioned nature is the supreme controller. Third is, it's an alternative, that alternatively, the modes of nature are the supreme controller. Got that? The modes of nature are the supreme controller. That's three. First is that karma alone is sufficient for creating your future. Second is that your conditioned nature is the supreme controller. Third is that the modes of nature are the supreme controller. Fourth is that the Supreme Lord is a dependent aspect of karma. Dependent aspect of karma. In other words, he's like part of the whole program of karma. He's implicated. The Supreme Lord is a dependent aspect of karma. The Supreme Lord is dependent on karma, your karma. He can only do what it's your karma to get, if you follow what I mean.
The karma referred to so far is reactions, not like karma.
No. Well, it's anything which is to do with karma. Anything to do with karma. But they don't really accept karma kandiya, though, that's a fact. Yeah. So it's karma in the sense of just working. Just you work. And then fifth is that the Supreme Lord is controlled by karma. The fourth one, the idea is that the Supreme Lord is part of karma. And the fifth one is that he's controlled by karma. In other words, he's separate from it, but he is still controlled by it. And the last is that your duty is your worshipable deity. So this analysis is given by Sridhar Swami. These are the six main arguments which Krishna presents to Nanda Maharaj. Sorry?
This is Karma
Mimamsa. Karma alone is sufficient. Your conditioned nature is the supreme controller. The modes of nature are the supreme controller. The Supreme Lord is dependent on karma, or he's a dependent aspect of karma. Or the Supreme Lord is controlled by karma, or that your duty is God. Work is worship. Now, Krishna could have just told them, look, I'm God, and you should worship me, and done some miracle. He ends up doing a miracle anyway. He could have just done it and said, see, I'm God, so just worship me and don't worry about Indra. But he didn't do that. In fact, he preached this Karma Mimamsa philosophy, which, as we said, is not Vedic. Actually, it's not even true. It's actually false philosophy. So can anyone think why? One of the Mataji's, tell us why Krishna didn't display his godly nature, but he actually preached this bogus philosophy in order to convince Nanda Maharaj to do Govardhan Puja? Suggestions? Anyone?
Not
a true.
Anyone you said his spontaneous relationship with Nanda Maharaj, his father and son?
Basically, yeah. And all the other bridge buses too. He wanted to protect the human-like nature, his human-like pastimes, the human-like nature of his relationship with the bridge buses. So then, just following on in the lines of this Karma Mimamsa philosophy, Krishna said that we're dependent on the cows, because they're part of our karma, Govardhan Hill, because the cows feed on Govardhan Hill, and the Brahmins, because they do puja for us and they give us directions on how to live nicely. So he said we should worship these three things, the cows, Govardhan Hill, and the Brahmins. So then Krishna, while still down at the bottom of Govardhan Hill, he separately manifested a vast form. What that form looked like is a little hard to understand, because it's explained that that form changed shape numerous times, but every different manifestation was very awe-inspiring. And then finally, he ended up in a sort of human-like form on top of Govardhan Hill. And Krishna said, oh, just see, there's Govardhan Hill. You should worship him. So then they offered all different types of foodstuffs. Any prasadam experts here know some of the different foodstuffs they offered? Puris, samosas, laddus, sweet rice, yes?
Yeah.
Huh? Sorry? Yes, sweet rice. Palava, someone else? Doesn't mention, but I suppose they did. Yes, sandesh and rasgullas. Also rice and dal. And there's one other sweet which, very nice, but it's halava, we already said.
Malpura.
Not Malpura, well, we already said that, but it's not actually there. And Laddu, we said. Well, I suppose so. Rubri. You know rubri?
Yeah.
You've met rubri, yes. Good. So all these nice things, they're offered to Govardhan Hill. We were there the other day and we told the story of Aniyor. Krishna was consuming all those things. Everyone had to run back and get more. Krishna consumed that. They had to run back and get more. Because he was, that form at least on top of Govardhan Hill was calling out, give me more, Aniyor, Aniyor. In the end they ran out and they thought, and he was still calling, give me more, give me more. Then, at least the way I heard it, Balaram came and gave one tulsi leaf. And he took that and then he was fully satisfied. So then the bridge buses circumambulated Govardhan Hill with the cows and bulls and everyone and everything. It was really a big festival. And Krishna said that anyone who doesn't observe this Govardhan Puja, which incidentally is, what is it? It's not a week today, it's a week tomorrow, isn't it? It's a week tomorrow. What happens to them? Yeah, there's a lot of snakes in Govardhan, on Govardhan Hill apparently, and they'll bite you. So, I'm sure you don't want to get bitten by those snakes. So you have to perform Govardhan Puja on Saturday very nicely. Then Indra became very angry and started criticizing Krishna. That's why we've written these words up on the board here. There are six terms, I think, is it? Six terms. These are six words used by Indra to describe Krishna in a very critical mood. So write them down, because you're going to need to know two or three for the test. Sridhar Swami gives a very nice explanation, and Vishnath Chakravarti Thakur, that Saraswati, the goddess of learning, she was actually, she sort of took control of Indra. And even though he thought he was speaking heavy criticism, actually the way he was expressing himself, it was like covered glorification of Krishna. So I'll explain these terms. Vachalam means talkative. This is one of Indra's complaints, that this Krishna, he's just talking too much. Got a big mouth. And Sridhar Swami says, yes, he talks. He's the source of the revealed scriptures. So his talk is like the real talk. So Vachalam, the hidden glorification, is that he's the source of all revealed scriptures. Then, Balisham. Indra was saying that he's Vachalam Balisham. Talkative little boy. Talkative child. Balisham. So the hidden glorification is that Krishna is free from any pretension, just like a child. But that doesn't compromise his position as the Supreme Lord. Rather, it's a glorification. Even though he's so great, he's such a sweet person, just like a little child. Then Sdabdam means literally standing up, or in other words, proud. He doesn't bow down. This talkative little boy is getting proud, too big for his boots, thinks he's very important, so he won't bow down before me, Indra's thinking. But the hidden glorification is that he doesn't need to bow down, because he's higher than everyone. No one is higher than him. Everyone has to bow down before him. So Stabda means doesn't have to bow down because he's higher than everyone else. Then Agyam means doesn't know, like ignorant, or does it, that he doesn't know. Indra is saying he doesn't know what are the real standards of proper activity. He doesn't know who I am. I'm big important Indra. So he's Agyam. And the hidden glorification is that Krishna is omniscient, so there's nothing else for him to know. Therefore, he makes no effort to learn anything. That because he is omniscient, there's nothing else for him to know. That's the first part. Agyam means ignorant. Yeah, or not knowing, he doesn't know the real situation. So the hidden glorification is that there's nothing more for him to know. Therefore, he doesn't have to make any effort to find anything out. Then Pandita Maninam. Oh, where are we? I left one out. Okay, anyway, where are we? Marchyam then. Marchyam means human being. So Indra was saying, oh, he's just a little human child, and he's ignorant of my position as big demigod. Marchyam. So the hidden glorification is that out of affection for his devotees, he appears like an ordinary person. Marchyam, he's just an ordinary child, talkative little child who doesn't know. Agyam, he's ignorant. So the hidden glorification is that out of affection for his devotees, he appears like a human. Then Krishnam, well, of course Indra was just using it as his name. Those of you who are Indian or know Indian, involved with Indian people, you'll know that Krishna is a very popular name. There are many people called Krishna. So Indra was thinking this is just another person called Krishna. So he was referring to him as Krishna, in the sense that he's just some person who happens to have this name Krishna, like many other people. But the hidden glorification, of course it's not that hidden, is that this is actually Krishna, the absolute truth, the all-attractive Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Indra thinks he's criticizing him because he's just an ordinary little child called Krishna. But actually he's glorifying him because he is Krishna, the Supreme Absolute Truth. Saraswati. Saraswati, right. Yes, she's the goddess of learning, goddess of speech. Then there's another one, which I somehow didn't put on the board, but it is Pandita Maninam. That's a separate word. Pandita Maninam. Which Indra is taking to mean that Maninam, in his mind, this little boy Krishna is thinking he's a pundit. But the hidden glorification is that those two words can be translated to mean that Krishna is highly honored by knowers of the absolute truth. It can be translated like that. Now, did everyone get those?
Repeat the last hidden glorification.
Pandita Maninam. The hidden glorification is that it can be translated to mean that he's highly honored by the knowers of the absolute truth. Although Indra was taking Maninam to mean mind, that in his mind Krishna was thinking, I'm a pundit.
Can you literally explain the hidden glorification?
Of that one?
Yeah.
The exact, how the translation is, that translation is derived, I'm not sure, but that's a way of translating it according to Sanskrit.
Can you explain Krishna again?
Yeah. The name Krishna is a popular name. And Indra was, there's so many people who are called Krishna. So Indra was thinking, this is just some little boy called Krishna. We're used to thinking that Krishna means God. But in India, there are many people called Krishna. Because it's like John, Paul, you know, Mary, Jane. These are names in the Western world. So Krishna is a name. And I'm sure in India now, there are thousands and thousands of people whose name is Krishna. So Indra was saying, oh, this talkative little boy Krishna, because that was Krishna's name. But actually the hidden glorification is that this is actually Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead. You follow the idea? Yeah. He just thought it's like a popular name, and this child happens to have that name, but he's an ordinary child. So I hope you got all those. Okay, let's go on. So then there's the very dramatic description of how Indra sends the Samvartika clouds, and there's a huge storm. Water is falling like pillars, and very devastating attack, actually. Just consider, Indra, of course, we normally wouldn't think as a demon. He's a demigod and a devotee. But here, even though he's a devotee, he gets, because he's become so puffed up, thinking he's an independent control, a big independent person, that he's trying to kill Krishna. Raj, Srimati Radharani, all the cows. So that's really demoniac, isn't it? That's really demoniac. So, even though normally we think of him as being a good person, but actually he became a demon for this period of time because of the presence of the Sanatha. So then Krishna called everyone, come over here and I'll lift up Govardhan Hill, you can all come underneath. The question arises, how could everyone fit under? We already heard that there was more than tens of trillions just of calves. How could they, plus all the other living entities, fit under Govardhan Hill? Because Krishna was touching Govardhan Hill, Govardhan, there was like mystic expansion. So our acharyas explained that all the three worlds could have fitted under Govardhan Hill. And Govardhan Hill was in such ecstasy, being touched by Krishna's little finger, that even though lightning was coming and smashing onto Govardhan Hill, and hailstones as big as elephants, pillars of water falling, very violent storm, but Govardhan Hill was feeling these things to be just like flowers, flower petals, showers of flower petals, because of the touch of Krishna's hand.
Normally I understand all the cows also fit on Govardhan Hill because they are taken there to the pasture ground.
Yes.
So they also fit under them.
Yes. Yes. Things are expanding here. The whole Goloka Vrindavan is here in this 84 kroshas, 168 square miles. Not just Govardhan Hill, but the whole of Goloka Vrindavan. It's said that if you take all the material universes and take like the whole space they fill up, that's the size of one Vaikuntha planet, approximately. If you take all the Vaikuntha planets, and there's an unlimited number, and add all their sizes together, that's the size of Goloka Vrindavan. So here in this 168 square miles is the whole of Goloka Vrindavan. So it's very mystical. It's inconceivable, quite inconceivable. So Krishna was there for 7 days and all the inhabitants were there. No one ate anything or drank anything. Because the inhabitants of Vrindavan, they were just looking at Krishna and they were drinking his beauty through their eyes. So they felt completely satisfied. And Krishna was looking at them and drinking their devotion, and he also felt completely satisfied. So no one ate anything or drank anything. There are many little stories of different things that happened, like one time Krishna appeared to be getting tired. So then Madhu Mangal, the Brahmin, said, don't worry, I'll chant some mantras for Shakti. So he chanted a few mantras. Then Krishna appeared to pick up a bit. So at the end, Madhu Mangal was going around, everyone was congratulating Krishna. Madhu Mangal was going around saying, actually, he did well, but it was only because of me. I chanted those mantras and that gave him the potency, because I'm a Brahman, you see. So in his mood of devotion, he was thinking like that. And Krishna at one time was looking at the gopis, and as he was looking over the beautiful forms of the gopis, he became attracted, so he started shaking. And then the cowherd men quickly put up their sticks and held, or put them up against the bottom of Govardhan Hill. But then Krishna recovered himself. So afterwards, the cowherd men also, they were saying, well, Krishna did very well, but it was really us. We were holding up Govardhan Hill. But while they were holding their sticks up like that, Krishna allowed just a little fraction of the weight to shift onto their sticks. And then they all started looking like they were going to collapse. So then Krishna took all the weight again. That was just a little fraction. So all these different types of pastimes were going on. And as the water was hitting the ground, our acharyas explained it was immediately evaporating. Excuse me. So when Indra came back, or when Indra came on the scene, thinking, now I'm going to have some fun. Now I'm going to see some utter devastation and just see how Krishna's been smashed completely and all these other nonsense bridge buses. He came and saw it was completely dry. And he became astonished, completely amazed. Then he started to worry. What's Krishna going to do to me? How is he going to punish me? So he was feeling very bad. And he was also feeling very embarrassed because he's normally seen as being a very big, important person, but now he looks like a big fool. So he's feeling very bad. That was why he went down to Govindakund to surrender to Krishna. He didn't want to surrender in front of everyone. So he went away down to Govindakund to surrender to Krishna there so he wouldn't be embarrassed. So then, when everything was over, when the storm was over, Krishna put Govardhan Hill back down, and everyone came and thanked him and congratulated him and praised him. People were smelling his head, the older ones, older people, kissing him, rubbing his arm, saying, "Is your arm sore?" Stretching out his fingers, "How are your fingers? Are they all right?" Like that. Asking him, "Are you tired? Do you feel any pain?" So the older people were doing like that. Then they were giving him benedictions. "May you subdue the wicked, protect the civilized, give pleasure to your parents, and be enriched with all wealth and opulence." So finally, Vishwanatha Chakravarti Thakur raises the question that seeing Lord Balaram was there, and he's in the mood of a devotee, but he has all potency, why didn't he do anything to help Krishna? Any suggestions why Balaram didn't try to help, even though he's in the mood of a devotee, and he's quite capable of holding Govardhan Hill? Sangashan, the younger, he was first. No, well, yeah, but still, Krishna doesn't need anything, but the devotee wants to do everything. Sangashan,
I felt like he just said that he knew that Krishna didn't need any help.
He was thinking that
he would also help
the devotees
take part
in
glorification
with Krishna. Not exactly. Krishna, from standing at talking, like that, he could look down and he could see the devotees. Aha, that's an interesting idea. It's not what Srila Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur says, but it's a very interesting idea. Yeah?
Yeah.
No, no. Well, the thing is that Krishna had taken a vow to protect his devotees, and Balaram didn't want to interfere with the vow, and he knew this is Krishna's desire. Krishna wants to do this. So if I took over from him, it wouldn't really be a service, because Krishna wants to do it. It was the stated intention of Krishna to do it. So now as far as the anatha goes, well, there's no need to worship demigods. Probably most of us being brought up in the West, we're not really so much into demigods. Although some Westerners also get into worshipping demigods a bit. Like on our altars, going back 20 years actually, one of our previous GBC members, he was in the practice of putting Lakshmi conches on our altars, because it's Lakshmi, and so you can get money. So he used to collect Lakshmi conches. But in the end, after just a little while, Prabhupada found out, and Prabhupada told him, you don't need to do that. If you want, you can keep one Lakshmi conch and worship in the mood of devotion, but don't try and collect them with the idea of getting money. And generally, worshipping demigods, I mean, this would apply more to people from Indian backgrounds, but to worship anyone other than Krishna is not required. It's just not required. Even in Nectar of Devotion, Rupa Goswami says, worship Ganesh. But Prabhupada, in his application of Nectar of Devotion, didn't teach us to worship Ganesh. Prabhupada once was asked, there's an exchange of letters, can we worship Ganesh? And Prabhupada said, yes, you can. But in order to do that worship, you need special permission from the spiritual master. And you need to give special dakshin. Special dakshin. So if you want it, I'll give permission, and you have to give me dakshin every month, $100,000. Then you can worship Ganesh. Prabhupada said that. It's in the letters books. Anyway, you know, the worship of demigods that goes on under the banner of Hinduism these days is more like, well, just folk practice. It's not like real, authentic Vedic yajna or puja. So we don't need to do anything like that. And I think more importantly, a more important lesson from this pastime is not to think that we're independent controllers or that we're independent at all, but to cultivate the mood of dependence and the mood of surrender and taking shelter of Krishna. In this regard, Srila Rupa Goswami, in Nectar of Devotion, he talks of six principles of surrender. Will you tell us one, Mahamantra Guru?
Surrender is humility.
Okay, that's one. Meek and humble, that's one. Riyadh? Yeah, you should write these down. One is to always feel yourself meek and humble. Another is to accept things favorable for discharging devotional service. A third is to reject things. So first is to always feel oneself meek and humble. Second, accept things favorable for discharging devotional service. And third, reject things unfavorable for the discharge of devotional service. And a fourth? Sankarshan Guru? To believe firmly that the Lord will protect, to have that confidence, faith, that the Lord will protect me if I surrender wholeheartedly to Him. I don't need to look elsewhere. So now that's four. A fifth one. Madhajis? Yeah, like that. To feel exclusively dependent on the mercy of the Lord for everything. To feel exclusively dependent on the mercy of the Lord. And last, but not least, to have no interest in life separate from the interest of the Lord. To have no interest separate from the interest of the Lord. So these principles are given by Rupa Goswami. Do you know the verse at Mahamantra Puru? Is that the one which is... How does it begin? What? Pradikul yasya varjita. And then dainya something. Gotcha. Do you know a reference for that? Do you know the verse number or? It's in Nectar of Devotion. I mean, Chaitanya Charitamrita somewhere. Oh, I see. It's in the notes for Nectar of Instruction. That's good. So these are the six principles of surrender given by Srila Rupa Goswami in Nectar of Devotion. And if we cultivate these particularly, this will help us to become free from the mood of being the independent enjoyer or even the independent devotee. That I'm a devotee of Krishna, but still I'm independent. Any comments or questions? Dr. Matt?
You mentioned, you said there are two main reasons that Krishna wanted to stop the yogis.
Yeah.
You know, he wanted to show that there
was
a need to worship demigods, and even the temporary results were given by Krishna.
Yeah, there's no need to worship demigods because they can only give temporary results. Right. So there's, what's the value of getting a temporary result? Then secondly, that even the temporary result is not given by them, but it's given by Krishna.
And you also mentioned because Krishna wanted to have another pastime where he could relate with all the devotees.
Yeah.
That's not included in the, one of the big reasons.
No, it's not one of the main reasons. Other one, Jay?
Perhaps you understand a little bit more about the different aspects of Krishna in his pastimes. Because I understand that it's only the Vishnu form of Krishna that actually is involved in killing the demons.
Right.
But when that happens, it's like Krishna has gone out with his cowherd boys. It's also included in a pastime with
yes.
cowherd boys. So I'm not thinking that that is actually the Vishnu form. So how is it being understood?
Good question. So the thing is that Krishna, in the body of Krishna, are all the avatars, expansions, and just all the forms there are of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Like when Vasudev brought his baby Krishna from Mathura to Gokula, our acharyas explain that Mother Yashoda had more or less simultaneously given birth to twins. One was the girl, Yogamaya, who Vasudev then took away, but she'd also given birth to Krishna, Vrindavan Krishna, So then when Vasudev came with his Krishna from Mathura, who's not exactly Vishnu, but he's Vasudev. Vasudev, the son of Vasudev. So it means like Mathura Krishna, Dwarka Krishna, like that. So when he was placed there next to Mother Yashoda, he then, at some point, entered into the body of Yashoda's baby Krishna. So he was literally present within the form of Vrindavan Krishna. But so also was Vishnu, Narayan, Ram, Nrisinga, and you name any, all of them. They were all there. So when Krishna killed the demons, it's very mystical. Krishna, of course, is Yogeshvara, the master of all mysticism. So it's not like Krishna's out there and all the avatars are within him. He's out there herding the cows. All the avatars are within him. And here comes a demon and some avatar jumps out of Krishna and kills the demon while there's Krishna watching, you know. But on the surface, it appears that the same Krishna who's herding the cows and, you know, our Vrindavan Krishna, that same Krishna is killing the demon. But the explanation is that somehow or other, even though we can't see how it's happening, but actually Vrindavan Krishna is not really taking part in the killing, but it's one like Narayan form or Vishnu form, an expanded form of the Lord, who is actually doing the killing, but via the form of the original Krishna. So, you know, it's mystical. Of course, then again, we shouldn't think that Vishnu is really a different person from Krishna. It's achintya bheda bheda tattva, one and different. Vishnu is Krishna. Someone asked me the other day that Krishna, who spoke Bhagavad Gita on the battlefield of Kurukshetra, it would seem he's not the original Krishna. He's not Vrindavan Krishna. So you can say that, which it's true, but still it's Krishna. It's not another person like you and I. We are two different people. So if you say something, I'm not saying it. So it's not that if Krishna on the battlefield of Kurukshetra says something that, you know, this is another person altogether who's different from Vrindavan Krishna. He's the same Krishna, but he's just not manifesting as completely as he manifests in Vrindavan. That original complete manifestation of Krishna is only present in Vrindavan. So that form of Krishna who is killing the demons, it's Krishna, but it's not that special feature of Krishna who is, you know, the Lord of Vrindavan.
So Krishna is pure ras. He's just pure enjoyment.
Well, he's everything.
Yeah,
he's particularly that in Vrindavan.
Yeah.
That is what is most apparent. But it doesn't mean that he's not other things.
Right. So it's when the Vishnu form, when Vishnu is more directly manifested in the demons, then the Vrindavan Krishna is still there. So
I was
thinking that there must be some other aspect to the killing of the demon that the Vrindavan Krishna is also still past that. It's not like he's a
Well, see, Vrindavan Krishna also has his Aishvarya moods. I think we talked about this, I mean, to some extent, one of the other days, that when Krishna sees, oh, here comes a demon, then by his desire ultimately, but immediately by the influence of Yoga Maya, he withdraws a little bit from his absorption in his intimate pastimes. And then it registers, oh yes, demon is coming. Now I've got to act as God. Yeah. But still, anyway, then we understand that this Vishnu form or some other form actually does the killing. So, but it wouldn't be necessarily that Krishna, Vrindavan Krishna, is still internally absorbed in the Madhurya mood with like no contact with the reality of the demon. Now Krishna fluctuates between the Madhurya mood of just being lost in the sweetness and then sometimes the Aishvarya mood when there's, you know, some of these special pastimes. Yeah, so he manifests both. We were explaining the other day that Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that you can't really have sweetness without both. His, you know, his very beautiful human-like feature plus his grand feature as the Supreme Lord. It's when there's some consciousness of his grandness, but also consciousness of his beauty and his wonderful human-like nature. That combination produces sweetness. Otherwise, he says, there are many human children who smile and go goo goo ga ga, and people cry about them, like that. So yeah, we would, in fact, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur discusses that, that when the demons come, Krishna actually withdraws out of the Madhurya mood, and he deliberates what to do, a plan of action. Then that's executed by some other form. Yeah, but it's not like he's simultaneously in another world, you know, of the world of rasa and... Yeah, like that. Any other comments or questions? Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.